Welcome to Recovery Radio by Landmark Recovery with your host, Zach Crouch. In this program, we'll discuss the root causes and treatments of alcohol and substance addiction, speak with experts in related fields, and help navigate the road to recovery. Now, here's the host of Recovery Radio, Zach Crouch.
Hi, I'm Zach Crouch, and you're listening to Landmark Recovery Radio, your source for addiction and recovery news and knowledge. You can find us online wherever you get your podcasts, and don't forget to subscribe to get the most up-to-date information from leading experts. We have guest Bo Mann joining us on the show today. Bo serves as founder, president, and CEO of Sober Grid. They are a digital health company for people in or seeking recovery from substance use disorders. Bo is an entrepreneur who has started and advised several digital companies. He's a member of the Forbes Technology Council and has been on numerous TV, radio, and print publications, which include the New York Times, Inc. Magazine, Entrepreneur Magazine, as well as Forbes. He most recently launched a successful digital health platform, SoberGrid, which has been adopted in over 100 countries and uses artificial intelligence to predict relapses and intervene. He currently serves on the advisory board of InvestAcure, a New York-based microfinance app founded to provide a way to find a cure for Alzheimer's. Bo, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you created Sober Grid after noticing a gap in the market for sober people to connect digitally. Did you have any prior connection to recovery before this?
I did, and it's interesting. When I first started it, in my early 20s, so around 24, I was diagnosed as having substance use disorder and entered into recovery. And I used peer support as one mechanism to my journey in recovery. And then when I was around 30, I was at a film festival and at the Sundance Film Festival in Utah, and I wanted to connect with other men or women that were sober in order to grab a cup of coffee or go to one of the film screenings, wanting to not sort of, you know, be forced to sort of go into sort of activities that were focused around alcohol. So it was with that background that was the genesis behind Sober Grid, and that's what led up to it. And when it started, it was more of a social networking, and then from there we grew into advancing it beyond the social connectivity portion.
Fantastic. You know, I've heard this before, and I'd have to find the study that proves this, but I've been made aware, at least, that success in recovery, especially early on in the process for people, even when they go to meetings, the people that go to meetings or, you know, are participating in their recovery, but also do things, as you mentioned, having a cup of coffee with people who are in the recovery process, who are like-minded, they do better. They do a lot better. So I think that that's a very important thing.
I think you're right. I think the research is out there that having this sort of positive social connectivity and community can really lead to improved health outcomes. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really the sort of one of the fundamental aspects of Sober Grid. It's about, you know, connecting with this positive social community of people that have the same diagnoses and working together in your journey towards recovery, and by being amongst each other and supporting one another, it improves the health outcomes.
And that's what we all want. So, as I mentioned in the intro, Sober Grid has been adopted in over 100 countries and uses AI. This is fascinating, to predict relapses and intervene. I'm really curious about what that actually means. Can you explain a little bit to our listeners what Sober Grid does?
Absolutely. So, you know, we grew, and I think we are possibly, if not the largest, one of the largest mobile communities of people with substance use disorder. As you said, we're in over 100 countries. I think we're around 170 today. And we have about 250,000 registered members. Wow. And essentially what we do is, with that came a lot of data. And so people post to the newsfeed and they really communicate inside the app significantly. And so there was a lot of text data. So with we're backed in part by the National Institutes of Health, the NIH, and they funded a project where we worked with researchers from Harvard Medical School and University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine researchers, and we developed, we used natural language processing, so taking the text inside the app and working with deep learning algorithms, and we were able to accurately predict whether or not an individual is approaching a higher risk of relapse.
Okay.
And so, so we came up with, and we demonstrated feasibility in phase one, and now we're in phase two, which the NIH has funded, and still working with researchers from Harvard Med School and Perelman School of Medicine, and we're looking to incorporate that in the live version of the app. And awesome. So we're really, really, really excited about that.
So talk to me a little bit more. What are some of the predictors that you're finding for relapse?
So it's interesting. And so what we're seeing is foul language is a predictor. And so what you can do is you can look and you can say, okay, I can give you some context as to how we come up with that. So if you look at a baseline, you look at, okay.
And Bo, to be clear, I don't want to cut you off. You said foul language. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
As in profanity. And what we do is, let's say that we take June 1st as a baseline to see that was the date of relapse for 1,000 people. We look at the language, and if there's a significant enough number of times that foul language came up, and then it provides a signal that that's a predictive indicator. And then you run it through, you mine the data, and then you run it through algorithms, and you come up with these signals, and then you can combine the signals to have these predictive capabilities. And then you refine it, and we have an internal senior data scientist that, you know, was a really smart guy that helped, you know, come up. He was part of a team that came up with the vaccination for hepatitis C, and just really smart data scientists in healthcare. And then we work with our data scientists and research partners at the medical schools, from the medical schools as well. So we look for the signals, and you'll see things that, for me, part of my sort of journey in recovery, and I recognize everyone's is different and there's multiple pathways to recovery, but mine was using a 12-step support group, still is today. And I would hear things, you know, that I'm seeing some of the research, so it's interesting. So if you look at spirituality, that really helps show a positive indicator that someone's less likely to relapse.
Right.
So it's really putting science using data and science and research to identify some of the things that we thought and make it evidence based through scientific research, and then develop other signals and indications that help come up with this relapse risk score. And the interesting thing there that I think you'll find really to be helpful is that you can have these great predictive capabilities, but you need to be able to do something about it if you can predict that someone's at a high risk. So what we did was we acquired this telehealth company that has it's a state certified addiction and mental health recovery coaches that was founded in Cleveland called Ascent. It was founded by a nonprofit, and in part with help, I believe, from the Cleveland Clinic Foundation. So now the coaches can reach out and say, hey, you know, offer the support, and that hopefully reduces the relapse rates and the overdose and therefore death rates. So it's really using data to try to for social good and social impact.
Talk to me a little bit more about the foul language piece. Is that a number one predictor, or are there other factors that you look towards when relapse is a possibility for folks?
So it's interesting. We're actually doing more research and scientific work on this. I don't know that foul language is the number one, but foul language could also be associated, and this is where our research is looking more into, with is that anger? And so is right. Anger, being angry is also has shown to depression and anger and different sort of states have shown to have these predictive capabilities or signals that an impending relapse is there to occur. So there's a number of signals, and then combining the foul language with if someone's sadness. One of the things that shows that someone is likely to be successful, it comes up often, is university. So the studies that show that someone's less likely. So looking at these words and trying to, and we have a lot of these signals, and trying to further refine, I guess if I knew signals, but further refine and then also couple some of the indicators and try to even get a deeper understanding of that.
So is this mostly self-report? They have the app on their phone, and then they'll go through a series of questions, I'm assuming. And based on the responses, they will then get, as you said, a relapse risk score. Or what are some of the other features or functions of SoberGrid?
Yes. So in part A, to answer your question, two parts. Part A, we do not provide the risk score to the end user right now. We did it in a study. So we kept it internal with the scientists looking at this information in phase one. But now we're rolling out phase two. And so we're considering whether or not to sort of inform the end user that they're at a high risk. We do plan on telling the coaches so that the coaches can reach out and offer them support. And as far as the other factors inside the application, we have a sobriety calculator. We have contingency management practices. So okay. Individuals get these badges. And then we also have these daily quests that an individual can do each day. So there's a gratitude list. There's a daily recovery.
So important, by the way, that piece that you mentioned, about gratitude. As you well know, if you're in the recovery process, which you are, and as you mentioned, spirituality being a big piece of what makes people move more towards recovery, man, gratitude's got to be at the top of that list.
Yes. Yep. Absolutely. One of the things, the reason we have to get scientific look at this is
one. Hey, Bo, you're kind of breaking up on me. Are you there?
Oh, my apologies. I haven't moved locations, so my apologies about that.
No, you're fine.
Oh, okay. So I was saying one of the reasons that we have this research and development department is we believe the same thing that you just said, which is if you do a gratitude list every day, that's helpful. And we want to put evidence-based science behind it and show and look at the data and show that individuals that did that showed to have less relapse or improved health outcomes. And so it's really important to do that. And we also the third quest is to engage with someone in the application, because our research has shown us that the more connections you have in the app, the more friends, and the more that you use the application and engage in the app, that the less chances that your health outcomes improve.
So I'm curious also, because this seems like just such a great tool, SoberGrid. Have you guys partnered up with other treatment facilities to use this, or is this still in the developmental stages so that you can refine it and get it to where you want it?
Well, we're always developing because we have this R&D unit, but right. we've been out in market for about 5 years, but we still have this new development, and we'll continue over the next few years to come out with new technologies, new products and services. So we'll always be releasing new things. One example of that is, in answer to the second part of your question about working with providers, we're actually live in a treatment center in a clinical trial right now which is also funded by the National Institutes of Health. And we're partnered with a digital therapeutics company called Trip that is out in California, and they have virtual reality meditation. So in this clinical trial at this treatment center, we are providing patients they can do the Trip meditation, virtual reality meditation, twice a day for a few minutes, and then they can also participate in the recovery coaching, and then the free recovery app itself, SoberGrid recovery app itself, and then we're looking to see how that improves outcomes once they discharge from the treatment provider. They'll be followed, and we'll be looking to do this over the next 2 years for this clinical trial.
Excellent. Let's talk a little bit more about the recovery coaching part of the app. How does that work? You know, I mentioned earlier this, and you did too, this idea of having a relapse risk score. My inclination is to think that as a person gets closer to that, higher risk of relapse, that recovery coaches would then probably intervene more. But I don't know how it works. So I'm asked the question, how does recovery coaching work on the app?
Yeah, absolutely. So, an individual can get a recovery coach inside the application, and they are available 24/7. So they go through training and certification, by the mandatory guidelines. They support multiple pathways of recovery, and which is what SoberGrid believes in and what our member base is comprised of. And they are available by phone call or by text. And the coaches, when someone joins, ideally they would be in this program for a year, but they can do it month to month if they're joining or any length of time that they think is best for them. And the individual can choose a coach and work with that coach, and the coach will help them develop a recovery plan. A coach is not a clinician by any means, so individuals generally feel more at ease when they communicate with someone with lived experience as opposed to a clinician. And so the clinician will help them and share their lived experience. And if they would like to develop the recovery plan and work towards that, the coach will help them stay on the journey that they choose to try to improve their mental health, and specifically substance use disorder.
Awesome. So here at Landmark, where we provide a program that's abstinence based, right? It's obviously one approach. There's multiple approaches to, as you mentioned, the pathway to recovery. Some of it, there's harm reduction being one of those. Does your app work with various kinds of treatment approaches? And if so, that's the first question. The second question would be, does your approach change if that's the case?
Yeah, so the app itself is, people that are in or seeking recovery. It could be, people that are seeking recovery choose to go Smart Recovery or Celebrate Recovery, mm-hmm. or just work with a therapist and use the community. Some may choose 12-step paths. So whichever pathway that they choose, or it could be mindfulness, or it could be a combination of all of those. It could be that they enjoy this cognitive behavioral therapy approach of Smart Recovery, but they like some aspects of Heroin Anonymous. I mean, it's really, these pathways are all sort of different for different people, and we support all of those, including, harm reduction. It could be someone is really addicted to benzos, but they don't want to stop their nicotine addiction, or they don't want to stop their smoking marijuana. So different people have kind of these different pathways, and we support them all. The app itself, the coaches do, and so does the app. The app itself is really a platform, and it just brings people together. And one of the things that I did very intentionally was knowing that I myself, my ideal recovery path is aligned with abstinence for me. So, not being prescribed medication that would be harmful, but I knew that, and I also had sort of a participant in 12-step communities for a number of years. Mm-hmm. But very intentionally, I knew that I did not want to limit a platform to just catering to people that were choosing my path or my pathways.
Sure.
That was challenging to do because sometimes there are different schools of thoughts.
Right.
But I think it's really, really important to have one community where everyone comes together and respects each other's pathway.
I couldn't agree more. So I'm curious, as we've been talking and we're, getting into a lot of the subject, about your app and the wonderful work that you guys are doing. One of the things that at Landmark, that's sort of our sort of true north, our goal, it's going to live well beyond me. I mean, our goal is to save a million lives, million families' lives for that matter in 100 years. And that's at the heart of our mission. Does Sober Grid have, a mission of some kind that you could share with us and our listeners?
Absolutely. Our mission is to help people around the world that are struggling with substance use disorders and to help as many people as we can. And, looking at my vision, I envision drawing that to the millions of people all around the world. What we say is that we want to help contribute also to the scientific and research community as far mm-hmm. as addiction goes. And we also want to try to help people find the right care at the right time for the right person.
Fantastic. What about your program, about Sober Grid? What's your favorite feature?
Oh, by far, it's the burning desire button, which is a button that's kind of sort of like an SOS. And so what that means is that, hey, look, I'm in need and I need some support. And when you press that, it notifies other nearby in your community. Being a tech entrepreneur, you have all the different things that happen, that you can celebrate and milestones you meet and exciting things. And I remember several years ago, I'd say it was 3 or 4 years ago, I was really feeling like I needed some support, and I pressed, the burning desire button, I was in San Francisco for a healthcare conference, and I pressed that burning desire button. And within half an hour, there was someone joining me at a coffee shop to just sit down and talk mm-hmm. and offering me support and research and sort of, places where I could go for meetings and to meet other people in San Francisco and have a nice, time amongst, sort of a sober community. So that was incredible. And I remember turning to my partner and saying, out of all the things, being in the New York Times or sort of hitting this milestone or this milestone, this was the most significant thing in my career at this company or any company, is to see that anytime anyone needs support, they press a button and they have someone there to help them.
I love it. And I want to put this out there, Bo, and to our listeners as well. I think that there's a lot to be said about being in this field. It's a privilege, right, to be able to help people. And with that, there's also a lot of people who are in the recovery process as well, right? I think, though, that what can happen sometimes, because there is such a demand for people to get into recovery, and also it's hard work. There's just no question about it. It's hard work, talking to families, talking to patients, the day in, day out of helping someone get on their feet and get their lives, going in a good direction. I think it's real easy for us, who are providing these services, for our lives to really get out of balance at different times.
Agreed. Yeah, I think so. I think that's easy to do. And I know, coming from, starting a tech company, you know, startups are all encompassing. I mean, you know, I think that would apply, you know, to you know, my startup in the behavioral healthcare space, but more broadly. And so I think, you know, keeping a balance is really, really important. But you know, for those that have started companies, they know it's so many hours and so much time. So you really try to have to develop ways that you can sort of keep a balance as far as the demands that come from sort of starting businesses.
Well, and I think that everybody could use one of those, you know, as you said, SOS buttons, you know, because I have a feeling, I have a sort of inclination that when you press that, my guess is that you probably found some ways after pressing that and having that cup of coffee with that support person to maybe get a little bit more reconnected to your own process of recovery.
Yeah, it's a great point. I think you know, absolutely it did. Connected me more to my community in the app, from a business side, and from a personal side, definitely connected me more to my community of sort of sober brothers and sisters walking this journey.
Awesome. I want to talk just a little bit lastly about what the public response has been since you've launched Sober Grid. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So we've had a great response from the public. We have a lot of people that, you know, applaud what we're doing, you know, making this app free so that people can connect with one another. The coaching, you know, is not free, but for the first 3 or 4 years, we just, you know, sort of built this tech business that was, at the time it wasn't self-supporting, so now it's geared to be. But, you know, a lot of people applauded the social impact that we're making in the world by connecting people all around the world from different walks of lives and different walks of pathways of recovery. We've been able to, you know, a lot of places have written great things about us, you know, the hot new app, and really, really, it's been rewarding to see a public response, both in the media and from families and our end users.
This has been great. You know, you said that you sit on, this is kind of an off topic, but you said that you sit on an advisory board for Investicure, and you guys are looking for a way to cure Alzheimer's. Can you talk at all about how that's going?
Sure. So Investicure is a microfinance company that enables people to contribute spare change, so money that therefore can be used to advance you know, research and development for treatments for Alzheimer's. And the CEO has been very, very successful at launching and creating this company over the last few years, and I'm incredibly proud of him, and I think he's going to do magnificent work in the world. And I think by enabling, you know, people in the public to contribute to that in an early stage is really phenomenal, and I have a lot of admiration for him.
Very good. Bo, I want to thank you for coming on the show today. I really appreciate all this information. This has been great. Your source for addiction and recovery news and knowledge. You can find us online wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to subscribe to get the most up-to-date information from leading experts. We have guest Charles All joining us on the show today. Charles is the public policy manager at Greater Louisville, Inc., also known as the Chamber of Commerce. He formerly served as the director of the State Legislators Project for Ballotpedia and as the chief researcher for the Almanac of American Politics. Charles will be giving us some insight into the role of local governments in creating policies to help combat the harmful effects of addiction in their communities. Charles, thanks a lot. I appreciate you being on the show.
Yeah, glad to be here.
So tell me a little bit more about yourself and what kind of drew you to pursue a career in public policy.
Yeah, I took kind of an odd path to get where I am nowadays. Like a lot of people that are in government affairs or do public policy work, they tend to come from legal backgrounds or political backgrounds. I actually came here from academia. I did a PhD in history, thinking a lot about how governments work, what makes government successful, unsuccessful, those types of things, and taught at a few different universities, and then worked for a little while as more of a policy analyst, continuing to think about things from a very academic fashion. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what attracted me to that in the first place was really just the concept of solving difficult problems and thinking about difficult problems. But when you do that in an academic setting, it tends to be very abstract. And not to belittle any academics out there, the impact is something you don't quite feel when you're doing that kind of work. And so
pretty sheltered environment, right?
It can tend to be a little sheltered, and you can tend to kind of talk to yourself in a closet. If you know what I mean, you're talking, no one's really listening, that type of thing.
Kind of an echo chamber, right?
Absolutely. And the world of public policy created an opportunity for me to translate that desire for tackling big, complicated problems and thinking about difficult issues into something that is more meaningful. And something that I think is more impactful. One of the things that every once in a while when I'm doing my job, if I'm working in Frankfurt or working in DC or wherever it might be, sometimes it does dawn on me that I'm helping craft policy, or I'm advocating for policy that could really reshape people's lives. Right. And I try to keep in mind that's not always for the better. If we do this wrong, I could really hurt somebody. And so that pressure really energizes me. It's one of those things that gets me up every morning and gets me thinking.
Creates
really
a passion
hard.
For you. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I'll add a little to that, you know, with a lot of the work that I do, you know, I do a lot of work on tax policy. I do a lot of work on, you know, environmental and energy type issues. A GOI, we kind of have to touch everything, but something we are, and me personally, I'm particularly passionate about, is ways that we can give individuals second chances. Mm-hmm. And I know that's something that's important to your organization.
Yeah, it is.
It's important to me because, you know, I'm somebody that's benefited from having my own second chances throughout life. Mm-hmm. Where as a kid, or really as a young adult, I got into a lot of trouble. I had plenty of run-ins with the law. I actually ended up getting kicked out of high school. And, you know, I got kicked out of high school and got put into alternative school. And it was that gave me a second chance. I remember mm-hmm. sitting down with the director of that alternative school, who said, "We don't really care where you've been, what you've done. Here's mm-hmm. a path forward if you're interested in it." And, you know, having that second chance allowed me to become the first person in my family to go to college, graduate from college, okay. get a PhD. I own a house now.
Yeah.
And none of that would have happened if somebody hadn't just offered me that second chance.
100%. And I hear how that's impacted you, certainly with this gentleman or lady rather, or whoever it was, it said that to you, you know, the second chance piece. I want to go back at more of a macro level here too, bigger level, in terms of second chances. You said you're really interested in what makes governments successful. I'm curious about if you could expand on that in terms of what makes government successful in terms of working with people in my world, you know, substance use treatment and mental health. You know, what has to happen, you think, from your purview, to make places like us and other organizations treating these people successful with support from the government?
It's pretty simple, to be honest with you. Government has to listen to experts. And the vice versa of that is kind of important as well. Experts, in turn, need to listen to government, and for that matter, politicians, in sort of processing the political dynamics. And if we can establish a good equilibrium, then we can accomplish good policy.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that's, you know, it's tricky right. nowadays sometimes. Experts like yourself, folks who have a really in-depth, on-the-ground understanding of the challenges of addiction. You know, if they're not communicating with individuals creating law and policymakers, then policymakers will either just ignore the problem, which is terrible, or they will try to make up policy on their own, which can often be worse. At the same time, it has to be a two-way dialogue, where, you know, policymakers are balancing the concerns of experts against a whole host of other concerns, and that needs to be done in a very delicate manner. But I would stress that first part probably the most. We have to listen to our experts. At GLI, this is something that we try to emphasize working with the business community, is we tell businesses and folks that we represent, like, you have to be in communication with lawmakers. They need to understand the nuances of this problem, and we need to craft legislation and government policy in such a way that it recognizes those nuances. Otherwise, we're going to create gaps. We're going to create unintended consequences, and that's where things really go sideways.
Stuff gets lost in translation pretty easily, it sounds like.
Yeah.
You know, what's happened so far that you've seen be successful in that sort of interchange between, you know, government and the local experts on the ground? And are there things that you've maybe even seen other states do that we're not doing that we could try to do to facilitate this, this tandem effort a little bit further?
You know, I think one of the places where you're really seeing, I think expertise is driving conversations in a whole lot of different areas, kind of despite what you might, I think that the more common narrative is all this chaos and everything like that when it comes to government. Expertise is driving, you know, government policy in a lot of different ways. One area, though, that I would focus on is criminal justice reform, which is a topic I spend a significant amount of my professional time.
Yeah, we've talked about that a little bit. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. For a long time, I do think that our criminal justice system was shaped by only a certain set of experts, mostly just shaped from the law enforcement perspective. And law enforcement absolutely has a lot of expertise in the area of criminal justice. But collectively, I don't think policymakers were listening to all the different perspectives in that conversation. We were kind of just focusing on this sort of tough on crime approach that was coming more from that law enforcement side. And I do think there's been a shift to where we're now hearing more from addiction experts, just as an example, behavioral experts, mental health experts, who are bringing their side of the story into the conversation. And I really think they are being heard. And that's driving this big push for criminal justice reform. And I would say not only them, but jailers, people who actually spend time in these facilities, they understand what it's like to lock somebody up. Absolutely. And those voices are being heard a lot more than I think they have in the past. And I think that has contributed to a shift in how states throughout the country are approaching, and well, not just states, but the federal government, in terms of how they're approaching criminal justice.
Yeah, because what, I don't know the percentage, but I'm sure it's very high of people who are locked up currently for nonviolent drug offenses.
That's right. People with some sort of drug offense make up the vast majority of folks that are currently incarcerated. Mm-hmm. And the vast majority of those people will also leave prison or leave jail at some point too. And it is absolutely imperative that those folks get the type of treatment that they need. Just simply locking them up in a cell, you can't punish somebody into recovery.
You can't
punish someone out of addiction. Right. And that's what we've tried to do for a really long time now in this country and in this state. And I think people would universally agree that's not working. Right. So again, inviting folks with real experience on how to address whether it's behavioral issues or addiction issues, bringing them to the table and having them have a voice when it comes to government policy is a really helpful thing.
Well, I think too, Charles, the whole concept of rehabilitation, okay? I think that term has gotten so misused and misunderstood because what does it really mean anymore? You know, what are we really rehabilitating by, you know, having someone behind bars for, you know, months, years, whatever it is, when in the eyes of people who I think really understand addiction, as a matter of fact, would say that, you know, what good is this doing someone rehabilitation wise? What are they learning in their new? What are they getting in terms of their rehab from substances? And what's the approach? And is it effective? Those are kinds of questions, at least from my purview, that would be very important for me, for legislators, jailers, those people that you named it, to really take a hard look at. And I think that they are, but I don't think that we're there yet.
No, I would agree with that. I think if you talk to most jailers in this state, for example, they'll tell you they have a strong interest in that. And they want that type of programming within their facilities. It is a resource issue for a lot of these counties in particular, because, you know, one of the problems they're dealing with is just massive overcrowding. I know I've talked to counties where they say, we would love to develop these types of programs that you see in other states. But they say the rooms where we might conduct something like that are currently full of beds. You know, places where they would normally have some sort of communal space, those have bunks in them now.
There's no room, right?
There's literally no physical room in a lot of these places. And with the current crisis that we're into right now, those resources are going to become more scarce. Mm-hmm. And I think what that means is we're really just going to have to get more creative.
Yeah.
Hopefully, drive us more towards addressing larger root issues. Namely, you know, some folks probably shouldn't be incarcerated in the first place, which is a root issue that I think a lot of people are starting to wrap their heads around now.
Right. I got to tell you, I did a volunteer day at the Louisville Metro Jail here, and I got to tell you, it was really rewarding to see the smiles on a lot of these guys' faces. And also at the same time, you know, to know that there was a couple of the gentlemen there that I talked with, and a lot of the professionals there that were working, who were saying, you know, there's a lot of mentally ill people in jail right now who are there, you know, as you mentioned, it's an overcrowded place. Who don't know how to navigate through some of the dynamics of jail, much less the social part of it, you know? So, that's a very big challenge for people who have, mental illness, you know, much, much less severe mental illness, which I'm sure that there's quite a few of those people locked up too.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very fundamental issue. And, you know, a state like Kentucky, I'm hoping that we can start figuring out some of these states that are kind of doing something that we think might be scalable for us right now. But again, you know, one of the concerns I do have, and, you know, not to keep coming back to the current crisis we're dealing with, is one of the concerns that we'll have to confront before too long is we have a lot of momentum pushing in this direction of addressing things like the opioid crisis, addressing criminal justice reform. I think it's really unclear now where that energy is at the moment, given that our attention is so focused elsewhere right now. And so it's something that I think folks that are actively involved in this space, they're going to figure out how to navigate this new world that we're entering mm-hmm. into right now, to make sure we are continuing to focus on the problems we were tackling before this right. whole new problem came right. along, and not lose sight of these things. We're going to have to learn how to walk and chew gum at the same time, I think, and it's going to be difficult.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about the opiate crisis. You brought that up. What are some things that the Chamber of Commerce, the Louisville Chamber of Commerce, is doing currently to help with that epidemic?
It's a great question. I will say this. One thing that a lot of the addiction professionals that we have worked with is they've actually kind of pushed us to stop thinking specifically about the opioid crisis. Hmm. And encouraging us to think more broadly about substance use in general, trying to get us to think, yeah. you know, instead of just addiction. Focusing on that mm-hmm. one issue. And yeah, and so we've really taken that to heart. Mm-hmm. One of the things, though, that we're always sensitive to as a chamber is there's a lot of great organizations out there doing really good work within our community and within Kentucky. Mm-hmm. And we very much like to avoid duplication. And so we try to figure out what's our lane. Where's the place where we can kind of carve out a path, have a big impact, and fill a gap that's not being filled.
Right.
So one of the things that we've really focused on is the importance of employment to individuals who are in recovery or who have been going through treatment or coming out of treatment. Because we know, and you know, how important that structure of employment is to
huge.
Having a successful recovery. It's a big thing. So earlier this, well, I guess it was last year now, we started a group that we call the Barriers to Work Think Tank to kind of think about the different barriers that people face when it comes to employment. And we mm-hmm. try to think about it from a whole host of different perspectives, but a lot of these barriers do coalesce around individuals who have histories of addiction,
right?
Because addiction is such a wrecking ball that it ends up creating all these
put it,
barriers
right.
in your life. Mm-hmm. Things such as you might not have a car.
Mm-hmm.
Chances are that there's a decent chance you're going to have a criminal background.
Mm-hmm.
You might have children without any sort of support network to help you find care for those children.
Right.
So we really focused on what can we do to help alleviate some of those barriers, particularly for people with addiction issues, that can kind of just give them a fighting chance. Now, with my work in particular, a lot of that has focused on the public policy side of things. And we do have business partners who are also just stepping up, trying to figure out what they can do without governmental action to sort of support these efforts. But public policy is a place where you get a lot of bang for your buck. And you can get a big return on investment if you can sort of make changes to these larger structural things that are shaping society, mm-hmm. whether that's increased funding for public transportation. We're making a big push this year for increased funding for childcare services in the state, because childcare is such a massive barrier to work for people who want to work.
Right, right.
Extremely expensive thing. And again, criminal justice reform has been a huge focus. If you're an individual with a history of addiction and you have a criminal record following you around, I mean, the odds are just against you in terms of finding good, high-paying, sustainable employment. And that's one that we have really, really focused on, and we're having some great success there.
Right. Because, right, if our goal as a community and also as the Commonwealth is to get people back to work, then those people who don't have the chance to do it, what are they supposed to do then, at that point?
Absolutely.
What you're going to see is you're going to see reoffending a lot of the time.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think you'll see reoffending. And I think on top of that, I think you'll drive people back into their addiction.
Yeah.
Because if you don't have hope, if you don't have a way to support yourself in some way, it's very easy to fall back into that. And we are adamant about making sure that that happens for as few people as possible.
What are the House or Senate bills right now, the state capitol, that if they were passed would have an impact though on treatment services in Kentucky?
Yeah, I'll highlight a few that we are working on directly. There's always legislation out there that is tweaking things related to public health, related to addiction. But I'll kind of focus in on stuff that we're working on directly. But a bill that we have spearheaded and helped draft is legislation that we're calling the Recovery Through Employment Act. And it is modeled after some legislation that was passed in Indiana a couple of years back. And the core concept is for government, state government, to work with employers to develop drug treatment policies. So if you have an individual, for example, that maybe fails a drug test, for example, or has a known addiction issue, most employers tend to just let those folks go. And one of the reasons they let them go is because they form a liability. If you're an employer, you keep an individual on your payroll knowing that they have some sort of addiction issue, and they end up somehow causing harm to another individual, a customer, or another worker, you're really exposed to a lot of legal liability.
Yeah.
What Indiana did was they created these employer-facilitated drug treatment policies to where if you have an individual in that situation, the employer can assist them in getting into some sort of a treatment program. And if the employer and the employee follow through with all of these things, the employer can have some level of shielding from those legal liabilities, which we think will incentivize more employers to keep those folks on payroll and to hire them. And we think that could be a really powerful thing if we can get that all to work. That legislation, that concept has had a lot of success in Indiana. There's a few companies there that have really capitalized on that, built it into their business model even, to where they're very focused on getting folks second chances, getting them into treatment, and then retaining them as employees. And this legislation is moving. We only have a few days left in the legislative session this year, but we think that there is a great chance of Kentucky passing that, and it could be a really, really powerful thing. I will highlight some legislation that's near and dear to my heart that I've been working on for about the past year, and we are inches away from getting it passed, which is some changes to expungement policy. You know, I mentioned, or you and I talked a little bit ago about how folks who, you know, if they have a history of addiction and they have a criminal record, that just the difficulties that they will face in finding employment, finding the stability are incredibly difficult. And GLI has pushed very hard for forward-thinking expungement policies in the state. We passed a really big bill last year called Senate Bill 57 that expanded Class D felony eligibility. One of the bills we worked on this year would create a new process to where if you are charged with a crime or some sort of offense, and that charge is dismissed, or if it is acquitted, the judge will automatically expunge it from your record. So an individual wouldn't have to do anything. It would just automatically fall off, which is another one of those things we think that can just help clear up people's records and help them get into employment. We think that's extremely important. I'll highlight one more bill.
Well, and back to that just real quick, Charles. So the piece around charges, if they are acquitted, at least, I think there's sort of a misnomer that people think that if it's acquitted, then it's expunged, and that's not the case at all.
That's right. That's right. It's a big problem. Whereas I think if you talk to your average Kentuckian, And you ask them that question, like, you know, hey, have you ever been charged with a crime and acquitted? Most of the times they'll think like, oh, it may be, yeah, but sure, but it's, you know, I got acquitted, so it's not a big deal anymore. Actually, it is a big deal. That's showing up not only on job background checks, but I mean, that might be prohibiting you from getting a professional license. It could be prohibiting you from finding housing. It's a whole host of other things. And again, I think what's important to emphasize is if you take that and add it on top of a history of addiction, it's a powerful obstacle.
Yeah.
For a lot of individuals. And again, you know, it's one of those things that I think can just kind of make the difference for a lot of individuals. That's what we're trying to do with a lot of this stuff, is just give them a fighting chance and remove some of these barriers. And that bill has a great chance. Now, I will just give a quick plug. This is House Bill 327. It was sponsored by Representative Kevin Bratcher. It's sitting on the governor's desk. It's been there since the 19th, and I'm waiting for him to sign it.
Okay.
Got my fingers crossed.
All right.
Any listeners out there. I'm pretty confident that we'll get a signature on it. Governor Beshear has been vocally very supportive of criminal justice reform, so I think we're in a good spot there. But
got it.
This is how it goes. Working in public policy is a bill can kind of become one of your babies, and you want everyone to like your baby,
right?
You know, you don't want anybody to write veto on it, so.
Like, it's like saying that you're an ugly baby or something. You don't want that, right? Right.
We don't want that. And we're really hoping to get the governor's signature on that. So, you know, even if maybe Governor Beshear is listening, 327, it's a great bill.
Andy, if you're out there, please sign it. Thank you.
I'm sure he's got a ton of time to hang out, listen to the podcast.
He's probably listening to this right now.
I will highlight one other piece of legislation that is unfortunately not going to pass, but it's something we're going to keep fighting for. We worked with Representative Nancy Tate to craft a bill that would create a fairly modest tax credit program to encourage employers to hire individuals who are exiting treatment programs and provide them with training of some sort. That could be educational training. It could be apprenticeships. It could be some sort of technical degree. But the concept is the employer would hire that individual, put them through these programs, and this tax credit program would offset some of their training expenses. It's a very simple concept. We don't quite have anything like that in Kentucky. A few other states have started experimenting with that. And we think it's again, one of those things that it'd be great if everybody was doing this already anyways, but the fact of the matter is it helps if you incentivize companies to take these chances and also to bear some of these costs when it comes to training. We're hoping that's a way to do that. But that's some legislation we're going to revisit next year, but we were happy to get that conversation going.
Got it. Well, I wanted to touch base just briefly before the end of the podcast. How is the current pandemic affecting your efforts right now?
It is it's an odd situation because in Kentucky we're still in the legislative session. And we still have some of these issues and these bills that we're working on, and they're still alive, and we're still trying to push them through because they're very, very close. At the same time, this crisis is of such incredible proportions that it's almost impossible to wrap your head around it. I'm finding myself spending most of my time now trying to help a lot of businesses that we represent just answer everyday questions that they're having about constant changes in government policy. Generally, government policy changes at the pace of a very slow snail. It is moving like lightning right now. New major, complete rethinking of concepts occurring every day. We've had an unemployment system for decades now that was focused specifically on transitioning people from unemployment to work.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't do that right now. Instead, we've had to completely rethink it to where it gets people out of employment and keeps them there. And we have to keep them there because they can't go to work because it's unsafe.
Right.
And that concept is, as somebody that's been doing public policy analysis for over a decade now, is extremely difficult to wrap my head around. And even more difficult when you get into the technicalities of it, and employers are trying to grapple with how does this work? How do I help my employees that I'm laying off access unemployment? They're getting questions, am I a life-sustaining business? Am I not a life-sustaining business? Should we be closed? Should we be open? Are we exposed to legal liability if we stay open? How do we keep our employers safe? Or how do we keep our employees safe? It's a cascade of different issues. And, you know, you and I talked about early on, in the back of my mind, we have to not lose focus of the fact that there are a lot of already vulnerable individuals out there. Some of the folks that you and I are just talking about, whether they have these criminal backgrounds or whether they have these histories of addiction, this is hitting them extremely hard.
Really hard. Right.
I'm fortunate. I still have a job right now. My wife still has a job. But I have a massive amount of anxiety every morning for the past week and a half when I've woken up. And I don't have, I don't struggle with addiction. I don't have, that's not weighing on me. But I can only imagine what that's like for an individual that does have that. And I just, my heart really goes out to those people. We can't forget about them. We do have to make sure that those folks are being taken care of. And as we exit this crisis, that we continue this momentum that we've had the past few years, and we keep pushing to make sure that we can address this addiction epidemic that is not going away. While it's not taking a vacation, while the coronavirus wrecks this country, it's still there.
Absolutely,
it's compounded.
Well, and I think too, back to what we were talking about earlier about those people that have filed for unemployment. You mentioned 3.3 million last week, that's probably closer north of four. Just because of people who weren't able to complete the process of that, you know, unemployment filing. So I think that during this time, especially for those people that, you know, have underlying issues, mental illness, you know, just simply reaching out, you know, if it's a phone call, if it's a, you know, something that could happen like that to let, you know, them know that, you know, they are not alone in this, is a certainly positive thing to do. And any effort really would help.
Absolutely.
So, Charles, listen, man, I really appreciate your time today. It's been great having you on the show.
Happy to be here and happy to do it.
So, if you know someone struggling with an addiction and are searching for answers, visit us at landmarkrecovery.com. to learn more about substance abuse programs that are both saving lives and empowering families. And until next week, I'm Zach Crouch with Landmark Recovery Radio.
Thank you for tuning in to Recovery Radio. New content for this program is available every Tuesday at 12 noon Eastern Time and 9 a.m. Pacific Time, with all episodes available on demand on the Voice America Health and Wellness channel, and through our content partners, iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, and Google Play Podcasts. Please remember to subscribe, rate, and review so we can continue to create quality content to help save 1 million lives in the next 100 years. You don't need to struggle through addiction alone. Live the life you dreamed on the road to recovery.